Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things. On community radio. Oh, this is the Danilana Kitchen.
Ho, ho, ho!
And happy holidays, everybody. A favorite time of the year to do fine things in the kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Santa Claus. No, I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Oh, threw me for a loop there. There we go. We
are Santa Claus, right?
And we are the Danilana Kitchen. We meet here once a week at the KHOI Community Radio Station. And we have a good time. This is community radio. We talk about food, farming, advice, opinions, recipes. And today we're going to be talking about some seasonal sort of things. And,
of course.
And we also get by with a little help from our friends.
Yes. Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames. Community-owned, community-focused since 1974. Open daily, 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op. And the Danilana Kitchen Show is supported by Farm to Folk, an Ames-based food cooperative connecting you to local farmers the year-round. CSA shares make great gifts for the holidays. Farm to Folk also offers local hormone-free and organic meats for the holidays, for the dinner table, and more information on a la carte buying and CSA shares can be found at farmtofolk.com.
Ooh, holiday baking, holiday tables. We are going to have a good time today.
Yeah, it's the holidays always have to do with the kitchen, don't they?
And some good traditions. We're going to kind of revisit a couple of recipes that you can find on the Danilana Kitchen website. That's Danilana Kitchen website. We have a recipe page there. You can go to khoifm.org. Find the talk section. Find the Danilana Kitchen section. Find the recipe section. And Donna is going to talk about...
Yes, this is a recipe that early on we posted because if we were talking about family holiday traditions. And this is my grandmother's, Grandma Baumgartner's, plum pudding recipe. And, of course, she's from a German heritage, and we had plum pudding, the real sort of plum pudding. And the recipe is on there, and it does have a few. I think the most unusual ingredient probably is the chopped suet, which is now not too difficult to find because we have a better local butchery system. I'm sure you can get suet probably from the Story City Locker, among other places. So, you know, suet is actually beef fat. So this recipe is a cup of sugar, a cup of suet, a cup of milk, 2 egg yolks, 1 cup each raisins, currants, and dried plums, 1/2 cup of molasses. You know that molasses is characteristic of these older recipes. Cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg, allspice, soda, and 3 cups of flour. Now the whole trick when I was learning to make it, because it was my grandmother had been passed long since, and I had to get the recipe from my Aunt Helen, who is also no longer with us. So I am the sole remaining purveyor of this recipe. So it was what I did was I took a bundt pan and you grease it, and then you put everything, the dough goes in the bundt pan, and then I covered it with foil, and then I put the bundt pan into a deep soup pan with something under it, like I think I have a round rack, so it's the pan, you're steaming it, basically.
Right, right. And you don't want the bundt pan to sit on the bottom.
No, nope, not because, on the bottom. Yeah. It has to be on the rack with the water underneath it, and it has to be covered with the foil.
If you don't have a rack, I have used underneath things to steam things in water, I've used a couple of canning jar lids.
If need be, you could make a tight roll of aluminum foil, yeah. Anything like that to keep it off the bottom of the pan. And you turn the burner on low and you steam it, of course, with a lid on it, for about 3 hours. And then you turn it out on the plate. Now, it's not terribly sweet. So, got to add some sugar here. I make a hard sauce that I serve with it liberally, and I make my hard sauce with cognac or rum, cream and lemon juice, and butter and brown sugar and vanilla extract and cornstarch. And, you know, the cornstarch is just, it makes a thickener, and then you can pour it over it. I think a traditional hard sauce is probably just liquor and sugar and water and cornstarch. But I like adding the lemon and the cream and making it a little bit whiter and more transparent and
stickier.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I love the hard sauce.
So, plum pudding. Plum pudding for the holidays, a fine thing to have, a fine tradition. And I'll mention a German recipe, too.
This is from Lana's family.
Well, yeah, Pfeffernuss. Pfeffernuss.
This is from the Nachtigalls, right?
Well, actually, a whole bunch of them. From my dad's side and my mother's side, we got the Nachtigall side, we got the Kahn side. And there's kind of two different traditions. Do you want your Pfeffernuss, your little spice cookies? Do you want them kind of poofy and soft? Or do you want them, like, hard and crunchy, kind of like Lutheran biscotti?
Oh, that's true. My grandmother had a puffy ginger cookie that was very traditional, too. With molasses, of course.
Pfeffernuss kind of translates to pepper nut or pepper cookie. And what's nice about this is you can make it, you can flavor it as you want, sugary or not. But I like to back off on the sugar and put in a lot more of the spices.
Now, we have this recipe already on our website, right?
Yes, and you can just plain go there, and it's got all my notes, as in, do you want to follow my grandmother Kahn's recipe, or do you want to follow my Aunt Ramona's recipe? There's always. But I kind of like the hard and crunchy kind, because these are little tiny, tiny spice cookies. And this year I made mine heavy on the black pepper, heavy on the anise. And
Up on the sugar and add more spice.
This is the kind of thing that is really good with strong tea or coffee. And find the recipe there.
So that's the updated version.
Yeah, yeah. So look at the recipe on the website. But still, you can play around.
How big do you make them?
They're about the size of quarters.
Oh, really tiny. Okay.
This is a refrigerator cookie. So you roll out these little rolls, look like snakes, and they sit in the refrigerator overnight. And then you cut them up. And, they're about they're not as big as a half dollar. They're about quarters. And they're made to balance on a spoon and dip into your coffee.
Do you want to put some Sancho peppers in them?
Well, we're talking Sancho peppers here because Donna found some. And we're trying to find a use for these really interesting hot peppers.
They're numbing peppers. So we've been making Sancho pepper jokes for weeks now.
I don't think I would make my pfeffernuss with Sancho peppers because it would really disappoint all of my German
Czech people. It's way beyond the tradition.
Yeah. So go to the recipe page there. That is khoifm.org. Find Donna Lana Kitchen. Find really good recipes for the holidays and the whole year. Well, I've learned a lot of things on this adventure here with Donna in the kitchen. And
we're fairly wide-ranging here, aren't we?
Yeah, we teach each other all kinds of things. And Donna's taught me about tapenades and olives. I didn't know you'd do so much with olives. She's got some really good ideas of what to do with olives and
For
the holidays. We're here at the kitchen table, Donna and Lana, at the Donna Lana Kitchen radio show. Today we're going to consider some of the fine food that comes out of France. You talk about France and you think food. Donna's got a really good book to share. So what do you have for us, Donna?
Well, I have a friend who's American, but she has lived in France in a little town in Normandy called Louviers. It's about an hour outside of Paris, and she has a number of books, mostly cookbooks. Some of them, actually her first book was called En Rue Tatin, which is the address is number one in the street is Tatin. And it's an old, I think it's an abbey that she and her husband rebuilt and turned into a, she actually has a cooking school for Americans. And her books, Susan's writing is wonderful, and her recipes are meticulous. So the first book that she had written talks about the experience of building the house and finding it and living in France. And she raised a couple kids there. And, you know, she's pretty thoroughly immersed in the scene. So she has a new book called In a French Kitchen, Tales and Traditions of Everyday Home Cooking in France. So while there's some recipes in here, there's quite a bit about the cultural aspects of food, which at this point Susan understands really, really well. And as I said, she's a very good writer. So I've been reading it. The early parts talk about how it all begins with Mammy, which is grandma, and the traditions. And then there's another chapter called A Dozen Great French Techniques, which are like technique number one is making mayonnaise, emulsification. Another one is about the vinegar, making vinaigrette, which is emulsifying. Technique number two is emulsifying hot sauces like beurre blanc. And that's, you know, those are the five basic sauces are how many? Or maybe it's three. I don't know. One is bechamel, which is a white sauce. And then this is kind of classic French technique. Technique number three is caramelizing. Number four is braising. Number five, which I use a lot myself, is reduction. And sautéing, which is a French word. We forget about that. Technique number seven is making confit for vegetables or melting. It's a softening process, basically. And the 7A is confit for meat. Technique number eight is crème anglaise.
What is that?
Crème anglaise is a great technique to have up your sleeve. It's the very base of ice creams, basically.
Oh, well, then you go.
It's a milk kind of thing. Number nine is roasting. Number 10, it's pâté brisé, which is pastry. And oh, my goodness, there's more. And baking things and cakes and cookies. Anyway, that's I really am enjoying reading this book. So, In a French Kitchen by Susan Herman Loomis.
Loomis.
That's right.
Yes, you shared that first book, the En Route à Tain. Mm-hmm. En Route à Tain. That was a dandy book, too.
Yeah, she's such an entertaining writer. You get the American perspective on it all.
Good. So I've been reading, too. And now I have an Englishman's perspective on French cooking.
And he writes from about Provence.
About Provence, which is kind of a whole different world.
Yes, it is.
It's kind of the difference between Iowa and Minnesota. You're going to have your jokes in between it. Oh, they can't do it right up there, and oh, they can't do
it
right down.
It's even further. It's kind of like, we had just done the show on North Indian cooking and South Indian cooking. There are big differences. And some of it is down to climate, because Provence has a more Mediterranean climate, and they go for spicier things and... Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful.
So this book is about Provence and by Peter Mayle. He was a writer, lived in London for many years, but transported himself and family down to Provence and has made a fine living. He's a great curmudgeon sort of writer. And I like, again, he writes not just about the food,
and his
but
books have been very popular.
Yes. I think the first one was You're in Provence, Toujours in Provence.
It must be in the front
all
of the book.
All sorts of things. Yeah.
So
but
this is...
He writes about his adopted country, about the pleasures and pains of living there, but mainly he enjoys it, and he's
a year in Provence, Toujours in Provence, Hotel Pastis, A Dog's Life, Anything Considered, Chasing Cezanne, Encore Provence, French Lessons, A Good Year... And another one, Confessions of a French Baker. Yeah. He's quite prolific here.
He always has something.
And he's very
to say.
English, no matter what he does.
So the Englishman looking at the Provence.
And this one is called A to Z, Provence A to Z. And you got this at the library, didn't you?
I did.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So I'm in the letter T. He goes through the things that are important in his adopted country. And this kind of tip my trigger because I didn't know this existed until I met this fine woman. Donna Prisgentis turned me on to the tapenade. The tapenade is something to do with olives, right?
Well, what he's writing about is the real stuff and you homemade it. you can make it at home, and Lana will read you that recipe. Mm-hmm. But tapenade can be bought in little jars, and it's basically finely pureed olives, either green or black. Mm-hmm. And what Lana's referring to is this little recipe that I found. I was at a really nice Italian restaurant in Minneapolis with my son, and there was a dish that was chocolate and garlic tapenade. So, yeah. Of course, we had to try it. So, and then once I tasted it, I figured, I can make this. So I've made it a number of times, and people love it. So you just buy the jar of the black olive tapenade. And with one jar, which is not too large, I don't know, maybe less than half a cup probably. Then you take some fresh garlic puree, like a good tablespoon, maybe more, and bittersweet chocolate. And melt them all together. So the garlic is barely cooked, the chocolate gets melt, the olives have that salty quality. And then you just spread it on a crusty French bread. And then at the restaurant, it was served with some quickly sautéed paquito peppers, which are very hard to find at Ames. So I have often just taken a red bell or a red and yellow bell and done a very light sauté and maybe put a pinch of cayenne in it, but not too much hot. But the color on the brown spread, but that chocolate, garlic, and olive tapenade it's yummy.
Now, that bit of advice could slide us into the holidays with
it's
style.
A very good holiday dish because, you can serve it as an hors d'oeuvre on a little crusty slice of a baguette with a little diagonal cut to it. And it's people love it.
Good.
And it's really easy.
Easy is good.
Easy peasy.
I'm going to read a little bit.
So you're going to read the recipe for the real tapenade.
Yeah. People in Provence are very particular about things, and they have their version.
If it's a real French recipe, there's probably only one way to make it.
Oh, of course, of course. And so this is From Provence A to Z by Peter Mail, and it's a bit of his musings going through the alphabet, and T is for tapenade. It has been called the black butter of Provence, although it may frequently be green, and it is one of those happy gastronomic inventions that sharpen both appetite and thirst. Normally, therefore, you will find it served with your aperitif before you get down to the serious business of making your way through the menu. The name comes from the Provençal word tapino, or caper. And capers are an essential part of every tapenade recipe in Provence.
I think I might have to try this one.
That. Okay. Other ingredients can vary slightly according to taste, but I recommend the following instructions by Monsieur Meunier, the Marseille chef who invented tapenade more than a century ago. Here is the original recipe. Take 200 grams of black olives, which, with their pits removed, crush the olives, use a mortar and pestle, together with 200 grams of capers, 100 grams of unsalted anchovy fillets.
Ooh, yum.
100 grams of tuna in oil, a large spoonful.
Oh, it has tuna in it.
Tuna. Uh-huh. A large spoonful of strong mustard. It says pommel de poivre.
Oh.
Yeah, I suppose that's the kind. And a pinch of fine herbs. As you crush, add little by little 200 milliliters of olive oil. And the final touch, mix in a glass of cognac.
Woohoo!
So there's a dandy one, too. The resulting thick and wonderfully pungent black paste, gleaming with oil, is traditionally spread on small pieces of toast, but it would be a shame to restrict tapenade to toast. Try it with hard-boiled quail's eggs, with tomatoes, with fresh goat cheese, with plain grilled fish, or a cold vegetable omelet. I've also seen it used as a dip for potato chips and eaten on its own by the spoonful. It's that good.
Oh, it would be good on potatoes, too.
Potatoes, ah. And I am told that some people have an aversion to eating anything black, probably as a result of being exposed to an over-swarthy cuttlefish risotto when young and impressionable.
Ha-ha, ha-ha.
There you go.
Now, of course, this could be made in the food processor instead of pounded all by hand.
Yes, it could.
Well, we like modern, but lazy chefs, right?
Well, this is a 100-year-old recipe,
mm-hmm.
and probably mm-hmm. the chef had staff, as all good chefs do.
So, well, and a very large mortar and pestle.
So we had a recipe there from Provence, from Peter Mayle, and actually a simpler but most dandy-sounding recipe from Donna with chocolate and
garlic.
And garlic.
And black olive tapenade.
Now, try that for the holidays. That sounds pretty dandy. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI 89.1 Community Radio for the Heart of Iowa. We're going to explore some holiday taste memories now. I asked Donna Prisgintis to tell me about her favorite holiday taste traditions. Holidays have a certain taste to them. Donna, what does the holiday taste like for you? What is the thing that it wouldn't be the holiday without?
Well, my favorite thing, actually we like to do this on the solstice, on the 21st, is to whatever we're doing and however we're celebrating on that night, we turn out all the lights in the house and everything's lit with kerosene lamps and candles, because that's the longest night of the year with the least light. And it's also the return of the light coming back again. So on that evening, or on Christmas Eve, or both, the kind of family tradition, because my son's father is from Brittany in France, which is a large amount of seafood around there, really, really good seafood. We recreate it here because we have good seafood that's flown in, usually from the coast. So we like to open oysters and have oysters and champagne. So I order, and this takes a little pre-planning, but there is a really good, we're starting to get great oysters on both coasts here. There's a company in, I think it's Connecticut, called Island Creek Oysters that will overnight the oysters right to your front porch. And it's a good time of year to ship because it's cold. And also the oysters traditionally in the months that have R in them, which would be November and October, mostly in the winter months, the oysters are supposed to be less milky and taste better. So that's sort of the beginning of our holiday is oysters and champagne. The other thing, then, this happens on Christmas Day, is my grandmother's plum pudding recipe. So that is on our Donna Lana archive recipes as Grandma Baumgartner's plum pudding, and I make that for Christmas Day.
What do the holidays taste like for you?
My family had a big tradition of making or having Tom and Jerry batter, and it reminds me of that. It's a great drink that you add libations to, and that particular drink is what reminds me of the holidays because it's one of the earliest memories I have of my family together.
Thank you, Cynthia McClure.
I'm Michael Morris, and as long as there's pie involved, that I consider that a holiday.
My name is Allison Canaley, and I own Alley Cakes, and I would say that the holidays taste like nostalgia to me. When I think of baking holiday things, I always think of being in the kitchen with my family and my mom, so I think of holidays are nostalgic.
My name is Elise Fazio, and the holidays to me taste like snowflake cookies coming straight from Alley Cakes Bakery.
This is Alan Gildahouse, but everybody, you all know me as Gildy. What the holidays taste like for me is when I was a young man and we would spend Christmas on Cape Cod with my grandparents. We lived in Concord, but every once in a while we would go up to Cape Cod to my grandparents' house. My grandmother, who we called Mamie, made this dish, and it seems weird, but remember, we're New Englanders and we love seafood. One of the side dishes that she would make is something called grouper fingers. And grouper fingers is basically a glorified chicken finger only made with shredded grouper meat and breadcrumbs and garlic and, oh, just the oregano and just the best stuff in the world. And when I think of holidays, that's one of the numerous dishes that I think of. But it was probably my favorite, I think, because grouper is just awesome. If you're a deep sea fish kind of person, grouper is awesome. And it's much cheaper than swordfish.
I'm here with Sue DeBleek, and I have a question to ask her. What do the holidays taste like for you, Sue?
I would say the holidays taste like cinnamon and nuts and beer and also chocolate.
And which ones are your favorite?
I'd say a combination of all of those is my favorite. Cookies with chocolate and with nuts on them and cinnamon and with a little side of beer.
This next holiday taste memory comes from Georgia. Not the Georgia that sits between the states of Alabama and South Carolina, but the Georgia that sits between the Black and the Caspian Sea. This is the story of sweets made for the new year.
Okay, my name is Georgi Chikladze, and this food is from Georgia. It's not very usual to have it for New Year. I mean, almost it's very exclusive for New Year. And the name is Gozinaki. So it's honey and walnut. It is cooked slowly together. It's on the very low fire, and then it's let to cool down for a while, and you're making a little kind of slim layer, like some panel, and you are like cutting it into the pieces, and you are going and distributing among your friends and neighbors particularly. And you're also getting the ones from your neighbors, and it's really important part. And when you're giving when you are giving this one, so you are wishing your neighbor or whoever you give it to have as sweet year as this Gozinaki, as this dish is. So it's really important. So it's associated with the year. That's why you have to like give the sweet one, so you wish them to have a sweet year too.
Carol Horowitz, what do the holidays taste like for you?
To me, the Jewish holidays, there are a lot of wonderful holidays that I celebrate. I mean, 4th of July is fun. But, okay, what does the holidays mean to me? It's tradition. It's meaningful, and it reminds us of who we are. And it's tasty and delicious.
My name is Ruth Burke, and the holidays taste like a lot of things. So there's always the classic cinnamon or vanilla, the cookies, the sugar cookies, the pumpkin pie, that kind of stuff. But the holidays also taste like, well, a really good stout or a good porter, really rich and chocolatey. And that's something we drink a lot in my family. So whenever I taste a stout or a porter, I'm instantly transported to Christmas. And, of course, whiskey. A little bit of whiskey and the Christmas morning tea helps you open gifts more rapidly, as my family likes to say. So, oh gosh, it makes it sound like alcohol figures prominently in my holiday celebrations, doesn't it? I bake a lot of pies, so mincemeat is one of my favorite smells. And, oh no, another alcohol reference here. I like to add rum or brandy to my mincemeat. I always think of mincemeat. And then, of course, I always think of the holidays. Lots and lots of spices for baking.
My name is Todd Michael, and I grew up in Ames, and I can't separate taste from smell. So my entire olfactory, gustatory, thalamico pituitary adrenal axis goes crazy. And the entire thing is evoked by the scent, smelt of pine needles. I believe I ate them when I was a small child along with the potpourri. The potpourri. I used to say potpourri. Is that still allowable? All right. Well, that's what it tastes, smells like to me.
My name's Ursula Rudenberg, and the holidays smell like pine needles, but they taste like cookies. And it's two cookies in particular. One is a chocolate cookie, which is really, really rich, and the cookie is in the shape of either a spade or a clove or a heart, you know, like from playing cards. And the cookie is really dark brown, dark, dark, dark brown. And it has kind of a slightly thin crust on it that sometimes has powdered sugar sprinkled on it. And when you bite into it, the really thin crust gives way to a really soft, luscious interior. And it's a really, really rich flavor. It's not super sweet like fudge. It's semi-sweet. And it has a real strong cocoa taste. So it's not like a super sweet chocolate. It's more like the cocoa-y, just really deep, deep taste. And that is a Swiss recipe, which I've never seen anywhere else. And it's really too bad because it's just an incredibly good cookie. And I guess the fact that you don't get anywhere else makes it also very special. And I would love to get the recipe for it. My mother made it. My mother was Swiss. The other taste is also a Swiss cookie. And this one is a more well-known cookie. It's an anise cookie. And it tended to come in rectangles. And the rectangle has a design on top of it that comes from a mold that is usually very intricate. It's usually the face of a famous saint or, you know, some intricate person or design. Sometimes it has a Christmas tree on top of it. And the cookie is white, and it also has a slightly crusty surface. And again, when you bite into it, it gives way to this really, really soft interior, which is white. And the distinctive taste of the cookie has to do with the fact there's anise seeds in it. And so it has this incredibly, pungent isn't the right word, but just very distinctive, kind of bright, aromatic is the right word, aromatic essence of anise, which just makes it a very, again, it's not a super sweet cookie, but that anise taste, it's almost like licorice, just really gives it a real sparkle and just makes it real delightful. So with both of them, it's partly the texture and partly this kind of really bright taste both of them have. Really, it seems to me like old-fashioned recipes often have really intense taste, maybe less sweet than what we have today, but more distinctively intense. Less of the sugar and more of some other flavor to give it its personality. And that's what makes these cookies so special. And the chocolate cookie ages really well. It doesn't get hard. It stays really soft in the middle. And the anise cookies do get hard over time. So they're still good, but they get that wonderful, they're great for dipping into coffee. It definitely is a coffee cookie. But I have to say the chocolate cookies, part of the reason why they don't get dry over time is because they never last more than a day or two. Those are always the cookies in the bowl or in the basket that are absolutely gone first. Everybody just like makes a beeline for those because you can tell by looking at it that this is going to be a really good cookie, and it really is. So that's how Christmas tastes to me. And I also have to say, we always, always, always had candles on our Christmas trees, and that's part of the reason why it smells like pine needles to me, because the candles had a way of bringing out the smell of the pine tree. And not because it was burning the pine tree. Actually, candles are in some way safer than lights because you never leave a tree alone with candles. You're always watching it. And the truth is, unless your tree's very, very dry, it doesn't burn that easily. So it smells like pine needles, and it looks like this beautiful tree that's surrounded with this halo of candle glow, which is just it's worth seeing at least one time in your life.
I'm Paul Nelson, and the holidays have so far tasted to me like a freshly slaughtered Amish goose, correctly roasted, golden brown, with goose gravy and mashed potatoes, and let's see, there was fresh cranberry sauce, and oddly, muffuletta, olive salad, Cajun olive salad. Boy, was that good.
You're listening to KHOI FM 89.1. This is Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Holiday Radio for the heart of Iowa. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about holiday taste memories. My holiday tastes like cookies. Many kinds. I love making cookies, but I've always loved the taste of pfeffernuss. It's a firm little pepper and spice cookie that's just the right size to dunk into coffee. And I also think of the taste of nuts. A bowl of nuts on the table with a nutcracker and nut picks to keep you busy for as long as you care to eat them. As a child, my brother and I were always part of the Lutheran Church Christmas Eve service, full of much singing, reciting of Bible verses, and stiff white choir capes. I don't think this is true, but I was led to believe early on that a stellar performance at the church program was a prerequisite to a bountiful visit from Santa. The time in church on Christmas Eve gave the jolly old man a chance for him to slip it in and out of the house. We didn't have a fireplace. After the program, all of us kids would troop down to the church basement in an orderly Lutheran rows and find our coats and our parents, and as we went out the door, a line of men would greet us, the church elders, most of them good Wisconsin dairy farmers, still sporting the farmer tan, sun-brown faces with their pale white foreheads from the hats they wore all year. And these men would give us all a sack of nuts, fruit, and usually a real live candy bar. We looked forward to that. We didn't have to share that candy bar with anybody. Ah, the taste of Christmas. Another holiday flavor that I haven't tasted in quite a while is mincemeat. I asked my friend Ruth Burke about that. What is in mincemeat pie?
Oh my gosh. The better question is, what isn't in mincemeat pie? So if you'll allow me, I'll give you a little bit of a history about mincemeat. So back in the day, when meat was incredibly expensive and valuable, you didn't want to waste it. So as soon as meat started to go bad, families would gather it up, and they would boil the heck out of it until there was nothing alive in it that could hurt you. And then they would heavily spice it and mix it in with things like raisins or dates and a lot of spices, cinnamon, cloves, that kind of thing, and they would bake it into a pie. And that way you didn't taste that the meat was bad, and they didn't waste the meat, and it became a holiday tradition. And then slowly over time, fast forward several hundred years to nowadays, people don't put meat in it anymore. They just put things like raisins and dates and sometimes candied fruit peel, kind of like a fruit cake, but that tastes terrible. And they'll put cloves and cinnamon and often brandy or rum is put into it. When I make mincemeat now, I'll make it a little more traditionally, and I'll either make it with beef suet or venison. It tastes better with venison, in my humble opinion. But again, heavy on the sugar, heavy on the brandy or the rum, heavy on cinnamon and cloves and raisins and currants, if you can get those, and dates or figs. So it's a rich pie.
So you put meat in your mincemeat pie.
Yeah, yes, I definitely do. It's mincemeat, dang it, should have meat in it. lard or fat, obviously suet. I mean, if you use suet, then that's your fat. But it tastes wonderful. It's very, very hearty, but it's also sweet, kind of sweet and savory. I like to eat it warm, fresh out of the oven, but you can eat it cold. It is the best Christmas morning.
Decked with bays and rosemary, and I pray all my masters be merry, for this deceit convivio, capo d'apri de ferro, redens laris domino. The boar's head, as I understand, is the rarest dish in all the land, which thus bedecked with a gay garland, in a celere cantico, capo d'apri de ferro, redens laris domino. A steward hath provided this in honor of the king of bliss, which on this day to be served is in better than
that was the Boar's Head Carol. The original was the Boar's Head with Mustard. That was the original name of the thing. And it's one of those carols that is very, very traditional, and it really has nothing to do with Jesus in the manger or angels or anything. It's celebrating a feast, although we do thank the Lord for the feast and all that sort of thing. You may actually hear this song sung at the Madrigal Dinner, which I hear is, it's that sort of carol. It's a processional. It's bringing in the food. The serving of the boar's head is an old Yuletide custom of Scandinavian origin. It was the first dish of a Yule celebration and was always served with a song. The chorus translates to, I offer this boar head and give praises to the Lord, which I said. That was a bit about the tradition of the boar's head carol. Was the Christmas hornpipe played by Al and Alida Murphy. I learned that the holiday classic libation Tom and Jerry was invented in America in the year 1821 by an author named Pierce Egan. to publicize his book and his stage play called Tom and Jerry or Life in London. It was maybe one of the first commercial product placement media tie-ins in history. It was a big hit. People enjoyed something warm and frothy and tasty in the middle of the winter. A Tom and Jerry is a frothy milk, egg, sugar, and spice batter warmed with boiling water. And, of course, add in your favorite rum, cognac, or other favorite holiday tipple. There's lots of good things to eat this time of year. Let's listen to this bit of Christmas past from a past Donna Lana Kitchen show. Donna talks about trifle. You wanted to talk about trifles. Trifle's a Christmassy thing. What is a trifle?
A trifle is, it's not a trifle to make it, I'll tell you. It's pudding, cake. You bake the cake or lady fingers, and then you make a pudding, usually vanilla, and you have whipped cream, and then you have various fruits. And you have these bowls, of course, that are clear glass so you can see it, and you start layering. You put the cake on the bottom, then you put a big layer of pudding over it. Then you put in some fruits, and this year I had the pleasure of Helen Gunderson's gooseberries, they were just like little jewels. They're so pretty, kind of rosy and white. And so I just gave them a kind of a quick simmer in sugar, so they were slightly cooked, and then I chilled them. And so then I put in a layer of gooseberries and then some whipped cream, and then I made a gelée out of some black currants that I had merely I think I just cooked them down and ran them through the moulie and then froze them up. So it was just pure black currant puree. So I added some sugar to that and some, cassis. Yeah, so I had the actual blackberries, black currants, yeah. Sorry.
But the black currants.
The black currants and then the cassis and sugar. And then I added gelatin. So when I put that in the fridge, it set it up so I was able to drop little jewels of black currant into it. So I've got cake, pudding, whipped cream, some fruit, which was gooseberries and black currant gelée. Just kind of keep, and you do a layer of each one, and then a second layer of each one, and then you serve it forth in all its gloppy glory.
It actually sounds way too pretty to eat, but once you realize what's in there, you want to get your spoon way down to the bottom to get all of that. So what trifle with the gelée, the globules of jelly bits in it, and that really added a lot. Because it's all about texture and nice, gushy, wonderful things.
Well, and it's also I was very proud of this one because I didn't, you know, resort to buying out-of-season strawberries or out-of-season raspberries, which, you know, typically people do, mm-hmm. Because you want some fruity bits in there. So by having the bright notes of Helen's gooseberries and then the deeper notes of the black currants, it was just, you know, it cut through the sweetness of the pudding and the whipped cream and the cake.
And the cake. It was good. And this was by candlelight. Candlelight, yes. That's a nice thing to do in the darkest days of the year. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is KHOI 89.1 Community Radio for the Heart of Iowa. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. I wish you a great Christmas. Great Christmas from Lana.
And Donna.
Yes.
A delicious Christmas.
We'll be taking a little break here on the Donna Lana Kitchen from live kitchen table broadcasts and taking a little vacation. Donna's off to a fine time in New Zealand.
Yes, my only grandchild is in New Zealand, so I have to go once a year. And I'll be gone a little while. And then Lana is going to get to hibernate while I'm gone.
That'll be a good winter for me. I will hibernate for a while. So tune in to the Donna Lana Kitchen for some reheated repeats in January. There's a lot of good shows that we've got in our archive, and we'll dig out some good ones and put them up for you.
And then we'll come back, me, fresh from the beach.
Oh, dear.
And Lana from her long winter relax, and we'll start all over again.
Yes, we will. Central Iowa has many fine musicians, and we'll go out with a nice Christmas wish from one of them. This is music from Elizabeth Zimmerman, a fine musician who lives here in Ames, and she has a Christmas album out called Peace. So, this is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
And we've had excellent engineering from Evan Taylor. Merry Christmas, and eat good food and enjoy life.
Ho, ho, ho!
Star upon the highest.